ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in today. I hope you're doing well. It's nice to talk to you once again. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and this is Red Eyes Radio. We are headquartered out of Sweden, Scandinavia, but you can hear us worldwide at redeyescreations.com and redeyesmembers.com. We have radio programs going back to 2006 on all kinds of interesting topics. Beyond this, we also have critical news and updates on the important issues that faces us and how globalization is destroying our world, how the conspiracy of the ideologues is seeking to get into your head with education and media to change you into something they see fit. We seek to help you to think about all the madness in a critical way, see what is really happening in our world. We also cover history, corruption, and cover-ups, and some more off-the-wall stuff on the esoteric, secret societies, religion, and much more. Petter Amundsen, a Norwegian organist, is with us today. Since 2002, he has decrypted a number of steganographic ciphers believed to be hidden in several first editions of William Shakespeare and Sir Francis Bacon's books. In 2003, Amundsen excavated two sites at the legendary Treasure Island, Oak Island, in Nova Scotia, Canada. His findings didn't go unnoticed, as it attracted media attention and many in the local community, among them landowner Dan Blankenship. Many years of research has resulted in a number of publications, TV series, and a full-feature documentary film. In January 2004, Rolling Stone magazine published a feature story on Oak Island called The Curse of Oak Island and included parts of Amundsen's theory on Shakespeare and the island. In late winter 2006, he teamed up with the author Erland Lu to write The Organist. This is an in-depth version of the discovery that we're going to talk more about today. In December 2009, a four-episode TV series, Shakespeare, The Hidden Code, was broadcasted on Norwegian national television. An English version is now being produced also. In March 2012, he published his second book, Oak Island and the Treasure Map in Shakespeare. This is an updated and compact version of the discoveries. In late April 2012, a full-feature documentary called Shakespeare, The Hidden Truth, was released in Norwegian cinemas, and an international version is available of this as well. This is a wild story, pretty interesting, and if you haven't heard about his discoveries before, I think you'll find it highly fascinating. Welcome, Petter Amundsen. Thank you so much for joining us here on Red Eyes Radio. Good to have you here. Hope you're doing well today.
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be a part of this.
Excellent. Thank you. Shakespeare, The Hidden Truth. Really interesting stuff you've been involved in. Before we kind of get into deeper into the steganography and everything else that you've been involved in, you're an organist, I think, at the beautiful Nidaros Cathedral, also known as Trondheim Cathedral in Norway. Tell us about how you came to look at Shakespeare's work from this point of view, coming from an organist background.
Well, it is the mystical approach, because when you are learning to become an organist, you go through all kinds of related subjects like theology and liturgy and symbols. And I learned a lot about Christian symbols, and my mind was well trained in order to appreciate what I found in Shakespeare at a later stage, much later stage. But it is probably also the fact that in the Freemasonic lodges, you need organists. And I used to be a member of such a lodge. And I think that if you bring all this together, the Masonic lodge, an inclination for symbols, and an appetite for everything that is thrilling in life, and you just happen to stumble upon a genuine mystery, then you have all ingredients, really. And I think that, looking back, that the organ training was extremely important, because you train your eye in a special way when you play the organ, because you have another stave of music to read, because you play with your feet. So you have to train your eye to read three lines at the same time. So it goes up and down at the same time as it goes from left to right. And And when you are reading or searching for secret messages, then it is good to have an organistic mind.
Interesting. So you kind of, in a way, set out to find it, I guess. I mean, we talk a lot about the Freemasonic influence, I guess, on this program in terms of the both the conspiracy, but also the symbolism, the occult, esoteric aspects too. But so were there any of the brothers at your lodge who are mystically oriented who kind of nudged you in this direction, or did you stumble it all over it yourself?
Well, I stumbled upon it myself. I was pursuing something completely different. I was trading the United States futures markets. So I was buying future contracts of pork bellies and soybeans and cotton and gold. And I was studying an old master's methods. And this guy, he passed away in 1955. His name was W.D. Gann, a legendary trader. And he had methods that would defy reason. I mean, he did things that should be utterly impossible to do. He had his market letter, for instance. He issued one in 1928, and he said that the market will climb and it will peak on September the 3rd next year at the Dow index 300 and something point this, and he published it. And what happened was that he got the day right, and he was off on the ticker by a few decimals. And he also predicted that it would be a big crash afterwards, and we all know how that went. And well, he was famous for having this uncanny hold on what the market should do. So this, of course, is highly provocative and hugely inspiring and interesting. So I was studying his methods, and he wrote a novel that was published in 1927 called The Tunnel Through the Air. And in the foreword of that book, he says that here is a valuable secret, but it is veiled, it's clothed in veiled language. Well, that was the expression. So he says that there is a message that is hidden, it's encrypted or encoded, if you like, into the text. And this means steganography, which means hidden writing. And in order to appreciate his book and to try to find the great secret that Gann placed in his book, because I thought that he had a need to pass on his wisdom, but he couldn't publish it openly. So he did this in an encrypted way in this novel. And he also encourages you to look for the secret. So I looked for the secret, and I needed to study the history of secret languages in order to go places. And it was during this self-study, this self-teaching, that I came across an old book by Donnelly, Ignatius Donnelly.
Oh, yeah.
Called Cipher on in the book and the tombstone, or in the place and on the tombstone. And he had deciphered the first folio of Shakespeare, at least he told people that he did. But he also mentions someone called Hugh Black, who did some work on Shakespeare's gravestone. And he was thinking that maybe because the gravestone, the original gravestone of William Shakespeare, had capital and lowercase letters intermixed in an haphazard way, he thought that maybe Francis Bacon's famous method could have been used on that stone to encipher something. So Hugh Black did this, and I thought, okay, this is an excellent opportunity for me to learn about the Bacon cipher, because Gann, in his book on trading, he talks about Bacon and he talks about Shakespeare, and I think, okay, maybe, perhaps. So this could be a clue. And in order to appreciate what Hugh Black had done, I thought, okay, I will start from scratch. I will not look at the Hugh Black solution. I will do it by myself. And then I will compare notes. And then I saw that Hugh Black had got a different result, at least according to Donnelly. And I couldn't understand why. And this made me focus on a certain part of the diagram that I had. And I noticed that there was one letter that was an E in Donnelly, and I had it as an F. And that corner, or that side of the diagram, spelt the letters FRBA, and I thought, oh, that's Francis Bacon, the initials of the man who made the cipher, who constructed the cipher method. So I found it interesting. And I saw later that Donnelly had just made a typo, but that made me look more careful on this solution that I had. And I thought, okay, but we have FRBA, but there is a center here. And then I did another round of decrypting and found myself sitting with a solution that really shocked me, because to me it was obvious that the final solution was that Francis Bacon was indeed part of this encryption on that gravestone. So that surprised me a lot. So I had to put the training aside for a while, I thought, and just to see where would this take me. And I had no idea about Shakespeare. If you had asked me when he lived, I would probably have missed with at least 100 years. So, but this was something that felt important. So I ordered a facsimile of Shakespeare's first folio, the extremely famous book from 1623 with 36 plays.
Yep.
Some of them, or half of them, actually published for the very first time. It's a maybe it's the second most valuable book in auctions. You have the Gutenberg Bible, and that fetches higher prices. But the first folio, that is really something, an icon in the world of books. So I got this facsimile, and then I began looking, starting on the first page, and I was highly suspicious. I was looking for clues, and then the organistic training is really helpful, because it didn't take me long to find some acrostics that, to me, confirmed that Francis Bacon had a finger in all this. Of course, I can't say that he was the writer or he was the only writer, but I knew that he had something to do with Shakespeare. And I still believe that he had something to do with Shakespeare. And today I believe that he was one of two primary writers of Shakespeare. But of course, I cannot prove that William Shakespeare did not write Shakespeare. But I think I can argue quite well to point that Francis Bacon at least had something important to do with the publishing of the first folio, and someone at least may have manipulated some of the plays before the printing of the first folio in order to make this happen. So I think that this is possible to agree on, whether you are Stratfordian, that is the group who believes that Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare, or if you are a Baconian or groupist or whatever you are, but I'd like to try to find common ground, because I think this is, I have found a mystery that should be appealing to all, and I think it's sad that many slam the door in the face of this mystery. And
why do they do that, do you think? Why is that?
They do this because it is offensive to some, and To others, it's just ridiculous because they know the truth. And if someone tells you otherwise, then you know that they are not worth while your time, using your time. This is a very sore question, and people have been fighting over the authorship of Shakespeare for 150 years or
exactly.
more. And, it is nasty. It is ugly to see what people can call each other over this rather petty question.
Right.
Because
isn't it about the material itself? Not that, I mean, again, this is how people are, right? The cult of personality. It's more about the person than it is about the message. And it's a hot potato. But I mean, this over the fact that it's offensive. God, I'm so fed up on that issue alone. But how do you think we should approach something like this then? In terms of, is that kind of partially while you put the authorship question a little bit to the side and just trying to kind of figure out, all right, what's the message in it, right?
Well, that is very true, because I've grown tired of meeting all these shut doors. I come in peace. I have no axe to grind on anyone. I just want to share a wonderful story, and I know that it is inspiring to so many people. But let me illustrate a vital point here, because we have this Facebook page, which is called the Shakespeare in Truth, and especially the Norwegian page that we are working in. We are collecting money from investors now in order to make a super special version of our film, in order to market it, because we need to have the correct format in order to sell it. In order to help motivate people to invest, we have videos that we launch for every 5% towards the 100% mark, and they see something special. And we also publish in between just to keep the interest there, which we are highly successful in, I think. But we have recently published a video with an interview with Mark Rylance, a famous actor, and he is maybe he's a Baconian, but I think that he is more like a groupist man, that I think that several people collaborated on Shakespeare. But he says one important thing, that when he opened up for the possibility that Francis Bacon was the author, then he was able to appreciate more of the finer things in Shakespeare, because he could never have paired the, let's call it, the science of alchemy with the plays if the author was William Shakespeare. But with Francis Bacon, it was possible
right.
to think in that way, and that makes a play even more interesting. And I think that that is really the case, because you open up for the idea that this is not something that was written due to some kind of divine inspiration, automatic writing by someone who we don't know if he went to school or not, but if he went to school, it was highly unlikely that he could have learned what he wrote in those plays. But with Francis Bacon and his friends, it is highly likely that he had backup from libraries and universities and comrades who could provide whatever was needed. So I think it's so much more interesting to look at Shakespeare from this angle than from the butcher guy in Stratford. But to some, it's a romantic idea. It works, and it shows that it's not a question of background. Everybody can succeed. Just look at Shakespeare. And
that's why people maybe kind of hang on to the story. But I mean, if we do examine it, not to get stuck too much on this point, I guess, but, you know, just if we look at the actor from Stratford, his parents were illiterate. I mean, there's issues with his autograph. They actually say Shakespeare as opposed to Shakespeare. There's no record that he ever owned a library. I mean, the tremendous knowledge that's been poured into the works of Shakespeare, there's nothing that seems to suggest that this this guy, this actor from Stratford actually had any of this knowledge and stuff like that. And there's just a number of points. We have a couple of articles on this on our website about this too, which suggests, of course, that there's something else to it. And if you do look at the Francis cipher, the Francis Bacon cipher that you talked about, that's something that's, you know, brings up and echoes some of the issues there in as well. But where did you go here in terms of the cipher? Did you came kind of up with like a symbol, for the lack of a better term, where if I'm correct in this, where you basically kind of overlaid it on the page to see the off letters and missing issues on each page of the original book that you bought, right? The facsimile. Tell us more about that.
Well, what seemed to be a differentiated cipher system really came together as one, but at a later stage. There were page numbers that were misprinted. We had acrostics, which means that you read the outermost letter on each line, up or down. There was some geometrical type of cipher, where you could draw a 3-4-5 triangle, and along the lines you had certain letters, etc. But what was really comforting was that it all came together, because if you want to look for something, then it is it's not necessarily likely, but it's possible to find things that are not there, but it is only in your head. But I hope that bringing all this together into one united system that is tied to the Freemasonic jewel of the square and compasses, that makes it less easy to dismiss as a coincidence. And there were some key elements here. We had the number 53, for instance, because I was looking for Bacon, and with a computer hooked up to the internet, and the world crazy about Shakespeare, then of course there are internet sites where you can scan through all of Shakespeare in just milliseconds. So
yeah,
of course I had to know on which pages do you find Bacon, and to my surprise we only have two pages where you have Bacon. You have four in total, but the two last ones, they are Bacon's and Bacon Fed, but just Bacon, those five letters, only twice in that big book. So I had to know, where are Bacon? And I only got the reference on this internet site, though, to the play and the act and the scene. So I didn't know, of course, which page in the big book would Bacon be. So I began searching in the first part, which is the comedies part, because there are three sections in this big first folio. You have the comedies first, and then the history plays, and then the tragedies in the end. And each of these sections, they are we have the separate paging. So they go from number one again. So I found a pencil and a paper and noted that the first Bacon was in Merry Wives of Windsor in the comedies section, and it was on page 53. Okay, let's go to the second part, because that's the histories, and it was Henry the Fourth, part one, and seeing this and act that. And that is on page 53. Wow. And then I needed to know what is on the third page, 53. And that is in the tragedies section, of course. And it happens to be that it begins the play of Romeo and Juliet, page 53. And Romeo and Juliet has a very famous prologue, and it begins like this: two households, those who have watched Shakespeare in Love will maybe remember that there is this guy who is an amateur, but he stutters, and he has a great difficulty in saying the first letter of the two households. So I remember that, and in the first folio, the whole famous prologue is missing. No prologue. Word two should have been there, taken away. So this is some kind of manipulation. And I also had found that TWO was what sent me to page two in the first folio. Those who have watched the film, they will know that there is an acrostic TWO in the beginning, the first poem to the reader, and then you go to page two, you find another acrostic TWO, and just across on the other column you find F. Bacon. And well, there are certain details that makes this stronger, but I knew it was something with two. So maybe it's just two times 53. And we have two Bacons, we have two pages 53 with Bacon on. And I knew that the value, the geometrical value, not geometric, but geometrical value of the name or the word poet, because P is 15, O is 14, E 5, and T is 19 in this alphabet. That adds up to 53. So you have poet, poet, Bacon, Bacon. And I thought this was pretty cool. Maybe Bacon was the poet. And only later did I appreciate that two could also be for two poets, the two writers.
Right.
Because I believe Sir Henry Neville is also part of this. But the 53 has another purpose. It is part of the geometry tied into the 3-4-5 triangle, because the internal angles of the 3-4-5 triangles, of course, you have the right angle 90 degrees, and then you have 53 degrees and 37. And I knew this because I had read something about the Rosicrucians as part of my Masonic teaching. And I had stumbled upon 106 in the work with the gravestone cipher, and also 53, which is, of course, half of 106. So things were beginning to click in my mind. Maybe there is some kind of geometry. Maybe the Rosicrucians could have been active here, because then I knew that the Rosicrucians, they were contemporary of Shakespeare, and also the first folio of, at least within a few years, because there were this Rosicrucian scare in Paris around the same time that the first folio was printed. So we know that Ben Jonson, he knew about the Rosicrucians, etc. So
yeah,
I was then on a Rosicross trail, because I couldn't really accept that Freemasonry was that early, because we all know about 1717 and the Grand Lodge of London, and
at least officially, some, right?
So, yeah, so it doesn't really seem feasible that Shakespeare should have been a Freemason, but a Rosicrucian he could have been. And the historian Frances Yates, she thinks that Rosicrucianism is the philosophical backing for Freemasonry, that the Rosicrucians were not a society, but the society was Freemasons, and they are really one and the same. And I have grown to believe that Frances Yates was right in supposing this, because the first folio tells me this with its ciphers that can be studied in one of my books. It's not easy to do this over the radio.
Sure.
you have to picture things in your head. But geometry started to emerge here, and the 3-4-5 triangle in particular. And I also found that the word rosy is just as rare as Bacon. We only have it twice in the first folio. And I found that it's all in the back of the big book in a misplaced play. It's in Cymbeline, which is a romance, should be among the comedies. It is placed with the tragedies. Page numbers, they jump 100 pages suddenly in the tragedies section, which means that you get numbers up in the 300 range where you normally wouldn't go, and all kinds of strange things. And the two roses, they are 17 pages apart, and then there are 3 pages to the last page. So 17 and 3, which is in the gematria, is 17 is R, and 3 is of course C. So we got RC. And on the first page with Rosie, you have a beautiful 3-4-5 triangle tied to the word Rosie, and the cross is laid out in this 3-4-5 triangle in the beautiful geometry. And when I discovered this, I immediately began to cry because it was so strong. I had been looking for things on this page because I knew it was something to be found, and suddenly it was there, and it was just overwhelming emotionally to find that final proof, to me at least, that the Rosicrucians were indeed behind the issuing of the first folio, and right, that Francis Bacon and possibly Shakespeare himself was affiliated with the Rosicrucians in some way. And that is when it becomes really interesting, because if the Rosicrucians are involved in Shakespeare, we know that they published 2 manifestos, the Fama Fraternitatis, in 1614, and a year later in 15, they had the Confessio Fraternitatis published. I used these 2 manifestos. There is this third, the chemical wedding of Christian Rosencross, but I'm not using that book because it's the 2 first manifestos that really is important to me, and especially the first one, the Fama Fraternitatis. Because the story in Fama Fraternitatis is that there is this guy, we only know him by initials, CR, CRC, and RC. These letters, they change through the story. It begins as CR, then CRC, and then ends at RC. We learn about his life, how he learns all kinds of valuable sciences, travels through Damkar, which might be Damascus, and then Egypt, through Africa, and up into Spain, and then he begins to teach, and people are not interested in learning what he has to say, and but he creates a brotherhood, and we all know these brethren by their initials. No full names are given. And then he dies at the age of 106. So there is the famous 106. And then he is buried, but we don't know where he is buried. And the brethren who come at a later stage, 120 years later, they suddenly discover his tomb, and they find him perfectly preserved, resting with a big book in his arms, and there is this lamp that is not the sun but took its light from the sun, and then there are all kinds of interesting things, there are bells, etc., things that could restore the order if everything should be lost. But then they decide to cover it up and not throw away the key, but they encourage other people to look for this grave and the graves of other brethren. So they are talking about a place, a specific place on the earth where there is something valuable to be found. And there is a big book in his arm, and there is this big lamp. And we know that Shakespeare's manuscripts have been lost since the printing of the first folio. The first folio is printed according to the true original copies. So at least for some of the plays, manuscripts must have been present in the printing shop, but some were probably taken from quarto editions, but manuscripts must have been present. And then we lose track of them, and some people guess that they were burnt in the big fire of London in 1666, but of course that is just guesswork.
Mm-hmm.
But Bacon, he has written a book called Sylva Sylvarum, and he describes in it 1,000 experiments that he has performed, and he also, some of them are just theories. I don't think that he really tested all of these out, but some he tested, and he talks about the preservation of bodies, and that is not dead bodies, that bodies, all kinds of bodies, items, things. And he mentions that it would be possible to preserve paper in mercury, because mercury is liquid and it's so much heavier than water, so it will expel all air and all humidity and would preserve paper perfectly. And he writes about this twice in this Sylvarum book. And all these experiments are numbered. And the first time that he writes about this is in experiment number 100, which is the value of the name Francis Bacon. Francis is 67 and Bacon is 33. So this is on page 100. And no, it's experiment 100, but it is also on page 33.
Mm-hmm.
And the next time he talks about the same thing, because he references the other experiment, he is doing this as experiment number 771. And 771 is the reverse of the value of William Shakespeare, because William Shakespeare is 177. This is experiment 771, the reverse. And it is printed on two pages because it's a very long experiment. It is on page 199 and 200. Adding these two up, you get 399. And on the last page of the first folio, which happened to be because of the jumping of 100 pages, the last page of the first folio of Shakespeare is page 399. But on all the extant copies of the first folio, it is misprinted, 993. So it is a typo in reverse, mimicking the 771, that is the reverse of Shakespeare 177, which indicates, it's not proof, but it indicates that the method that Bacon describes, that uses mercury to preserve paper, could have been used to preserve some manuscripts or paper related to the first folio. And I knew that Oak Island was a place where they had found traces of mercury and also a tiny bit of a parchment. And from this discovery, some people have been thinking that maybe Shakespeare's manuscripts could have been buried on Oak Island.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have these experiments that to someone who is familiar with numbers meaning something more than just being numbers, he's thinking that, oh, maybe it's not such a stupid supposition after all to have the Shakespearean manuscripts on Oak Island. But what could it be? And I had watched a video that was published
in the 90s about Oak Island. And there is this interview with a man called Fred Nolan, who is a land surveyor. And he had discovered on his own property that there is a gigantic cross made of five huge boulders. And this cross works symbolically in the imperial feet. So we have 360 feet, the length of each arm. It's a perfect right angle. And then there are other numbers that he didn't get any meaning from. But I saw that on this video, that the third boulder making up the stem of the cross, because of you have three boulders in line, the stem, and then you have one on each side. But the one in the middle was not in the middle at the junction of the cross. It was down the stem. And watching this video, I thought immediately, wow, that could be a tree of life. I mean, it's five of the Sephiroth.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't give it more thought. I was thinking maybe some Christian Kabbalist could have been doing something on the island. But that wasn't really my field, because I was so much into W.D. Gann that I didn't really look for clues on Shakespeare and Bacon, etc. But I found it interesting. But later, when I noticed the Rosicrucian possibility in Shakespeare, and knowing that the Rosicrucians, they were Christian Kabbalists, and then hey, you got this mercury preservation method that is described by Bacon using these numbers uniting Bacon and Shakespeare, and people are claiming to have found mercury in the money pit on Oak Island. How? And then I bought a book about Oak Island and found the dimensions of the cross and quickly extrapolated the remaining five Sephiroth of the Tree of Life that I thought was there, and found that I needed to adjust a little bit. I had to change one of the distances from 293 feet to 294 feet. And that could seem like curve fitting, but having inspected these stones at the later stage, I know that, having taken the measures myself, I know that it could just as well be 294 as 293. But 294, if you think in the gematria world, that is the Valley of Rhodon in Greek. So that is a rosy cross by itself from that measurements.
Mm.
That makes it click together, so you have a perfect 5x8 tree of life. And of course then you have 720 feet across because of the two arms of 360 feet, and the full length is 1152 feet. So I knew I had to visit Oak Island to dig at these new Sephiroth that I had calculated. And this is what I did in 2003, which can be seen on our film, because we have footage from 2003. So I went there and I excavated on the Kingdom Sephiroth and also on the Victory Sephiroth. And there is this Swedish guy called Daniel Ronstam. He was visiting the island in last summer, and when I was there in 03, I didn't have enough time to dig the Victory Stone really out of the ground, but Daniel and some of the owners did this in during last summer, and he showed me a picture which we really recently published on our Facebook page. And then you can see that the stones that I found on Kingdom and Victory, they are very similar. And we ordered a backhoe to dig around the Kingdom stone in order to check if these stones are lying all over the place, and they did not. So it could be a crazy coincidence that you find two stones like this on each of the Sephiroths that I had pre-calculated, but I think that we should pursue this further on. And to jump to the last page, and that is the last page of The Tempest, the play of Shakespeare. You'll find on page 19 of the book that overlaying the Tree of Life as it is found on Oak Island 5x8, you'll see that the Sephira Mercy is found at the word mercy on the last page of the Tempest. And he's talking about piercing mercy. And when you pierce mercy, you should free all faults. And that is what we are hoping to do. We hope to free all faults by piercing mercy. And those who have watched the History Channel series, The Curse of Oak Island.
Sure, yeah.
They would see people searching at mercy, and they found not only a flat floor, it is just flat, like a dining table, the dining room table, I was told, and which is, it might be strange because there is this beach of round stones, we call them rolling stones in Norwegian. I don't know what the English word is, but
right.
Yeah, I get no satisfaction. But they found a coin there from the period that I was thinking could be the correct period. It's a coin that was minted between 1550 and 1650, a Spanish coin, missing the year, but we know the type.
Kind of the pirate coin, right? What they call it?
That's right, yeah. And so what is the Spanish connection here? That must be difficult for my theory, but on the other hand, maybe not, because if you need a lot of mercury, you don't go down to the apothecary and buy it on the corner. You go and get it wholesale, and maybe you need some workers as well. So you could go to Spain. And there are some famous mines in Almeda who were extracting mercury, and they were notorious for having slaves and convicts working there. So maybe it's a good idea if you want to do something sub rosa, then you bring foreign workers and you also get the mercury need. And so you go south first and then you go west. So maybe this is the connection that some of the workers threw a coin on top of it for good luck when it was finished, or simply just dropped it. But the mercy point out in that swamp is a place where it is almost impossible to get to without draining the swamp first, and then you need big plywood boards to hold you. You can't just walk out there. Of course, you could build a raft, but why would you bother to go out there? So at least that coin, if it was not planted, which I don't think, why would someone lose or drop a coin at Mercy Point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's interesting. So my hope is that the Canadian authorities will pass a bill that will be reissued later this fall, called Bill 68 at present, that will ensure that an archaeologist need to be supervising what is happening. Because I think we need to have everything documented in a scholarly way, and this could be really important, and not rushing things. I'm not saying that the present owners are reckless, but I think that they all would benefit from having an archaeologist on board. And I hope that this law will pass this fall, and I hope that our film, if it is re-edited and becomes this wonderful three-episode international film that we hope it could be, will help move things in Canada, so that they appreciate what a unique place they have. To me, it's a new temple, of God, and it is the resting place for this big lamp that I mentioned, which I believe is the menorah, because in Kabbalistic lore it is described in the same way. It's not the sun, but it has taken its light from the sun. The same way of talking about things and
the treasure, right, that was taken under the Temple Mount kind of thing.
Yes, it was stolen from the temple by the Romans under Titus. And of course, it is in the play Titus on page 37, which is fitting with the Rosicrucian idea that to find more clues, to hide so much gold under a tree. And the guy who hides this is called Aaron, and Aaron is the guy who is responsible for taking care of the ark and the lamp. So it all fits beautifully together, or it could be beautiful coincidences at worst, but it's something that you could really enjoy and join in for the ride. So the last word has not been said on this matter, and we are making history as we proceed, and it's just wonderful to be part of this.
Well, very good. I know we need to wrap things up here for the first segment here. Obviously, we need to continue and talk more about this in the second. There's just so many more questions I have for you, Petter, in regards to...
I would like that.
So, yeah, let's do that, because there's much more to it, of course. But why don't you just wrap up here, giving us your website where people can read more about the film, pick up copies of the film if they want to see more, and then we'll save all the other questions I have for the second segment.
Well, it is on Facebook. So you look for Shakespeare, The Hidden Truth. And recently, the most interesting parts are happening on the sister page, which is in Norwegian. It's called Shakespeare's Skjulte Koder, but you will find a link to it if you go to Shakespeare, The Hidden Truth. And if you invest and a share costs €49, then you get the code words, the passwords to watch all these interesting videos, and you will see the whole film. You'll see the four-part Norwegian documentary, which will be subtitled. So you get a lot for your investment, but most of all, you help our cause to make this super-duper version of everything we got. So I invite everybody to join in on this, to become part of this team.
Right, very good. Check out the film and everything else, all the details about this on ShakespeareTheHiddenTruth.com. And also we're going to link up the Facebook page that Petter mentioned as well. All right, well, much more coming on this. Many more questions for you, Petter. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more.
Take these shoes, click-clacking down some dead-end street. Take these shoes. Take this shirt, polyester white trash made in nowhere. Take this shirt and make it clean, clean. Take this soul, stranded in some skin and bones. Take this soul and make it safe.
Still I'm waiting for the time.
take this city. The city should be shining all night, yeah. Take this city, if it be your will. What no man can own, no man can take. Take this heart, take this heart, take this heart and make it break.